So I don't see Bridget or Philip, Steve. Yeah, she's right there.
Hi, Josh.
Josh.
Sweet, thank you.
Autumn? Anyone else I'm missing? So, Abby, John. So I got Philip, Bridget, and Garrett. So you know the high score is set equal to 100, so 63 was the high score for the class. People pretty much did about the same as they did on the previous exam. On average, people scored about 2 points better, but there was huge shuffling. So somebody went down 41 points, somebody went up 36 points. So only about one third of the class was within 7 points of their score on the first exam. So whole lot of ups and downs. Questions? So they'll very soon be, all I have to do is change the protection code, very soon be webcasts that have the answers. I don't know if you have any kind of immediate questions. So the green score is your homework score since the last exam. So if you wanted to figure out where you were in this class kind of right now, go to your old exam and you could add the numerators and the denominators for your homework score and figure out where you are in homework. You should know where you are in lab, so you could average that score, homework score, and your two exam scores, and you should have a pretty fair idea of where you are currently. No, so what's listed there is HW is the quiz and the WebAssign homework. So your lab grade is yet another test grade to be averaged in.
Okay, what else does the homework score include?
So it's everything since the last exam, WebAssign and quizzes. And if you have plus something, then that's the bonus that you got from the... I didn't adjust it. I thought about it, but... I said I was going to do X, so I think I have to do X. And mostly it would just hurt the couple of people who got the 28 points as opposed to helping the other people. I'll probably change what I do next time. Questions?
I don't want to hear another word. Any negativity from you for the rest of the remainder of the year? All right.
Okay, so on to chapter 9. In chapter 9, we start to deal with applying what we've learned to solids and liquids. And as a result, we're going to have actually a fair number of equations today that are going to be important, but I hope they're kind of clearer sorts of equations. So we're going to start by talking about solids. And really the starting point for all of this stuff is to talk about the idea of pressure. So pressure is a force per area. So in typical sorts of units, it would be measured in newtons per square meter. In kind of English units, it might be measured in pounds per square inch. And, you know, the famous dead physicist whose name for Newton per square meter is Pascal. And one Pascal pressure is a pretty wimpy pressure. So, for example, atmospheric pressure is like 100,000 Pascals. So typically you're going to have a huge number of Newtons per square meter, basically because you have, I mean, a square meter encompasses a big, a whole big area. So if we take a solid and we subject it to a force, it's going to change in its size. So if I put this 1 kilogram weight on top of this aluminum pipe, you can see that it's changed its length noticeably. Well, maybe not so much, right? So it's kind of funny, we have this word springy for things that aren't very springy. That is to say, whose shape doesn't change very much, or it does change a lot for a given force. But things that really are springy, like steel, kind of don't usually get that name of being elastic, the way we think about springs being elastic. But they are. It's just that they're so stiff that we can't really see the displacement very well. But in fact, of course, any old solid kind of has this sort of structure where we have atoms that are held together by bonds, which we can approximate by springs. And if we put a weight on any old structure, it's going to deform. Now, I don't know, the desk didn't deform a whole lot when I put that on there, but I claim it did deform some. So the springiness for solids is relatively large. That is to say, they don't change their length very much. We can parameterize how much they change their length on by using what's called Young's modulus. We're actually going to talk about three different moduluses in a short period of time. So if I have an object and I put a weight on it, we can see a certain amount of change in length. Crash. And the change in length is proportional to the length. That is to say, every piece of this is the same. So we're really going to be interested in how the length change per length. And this thing is going to respond to the pressure that we apply to the top. And, of course, pressure is going to be force per area. The bigger the force per area, the more the deformation. And the fudge factor that goes in here is Young's modulus. Okay, so these things all have kind of special names. In this context, the force per area is usually called the stress. And the change in the dimensions are usually called the strain. So we say that strain is proportional to the stress. Oops. Yeah, actually I have my Y on the wrong side. So Y, since this is unitless and this has the units of pressure, Y is going to have the units of pressure. It's going to be measured in Pascals. And typically it's going to be a huge number of Pascals because the deformation is going to be correspondingly small. Okay, so if we apply some stress to an object and we can measure the strain, that's the deformation of it, what this equation says is that as we increase the stress, the deformation is going to increase linearly with it. But I hope it's clear that that doesn't last forever. There's some sort of breaking point that occurs when we put too much stress on an object, it'll actually break. So this region where we have approximately linear relationship between the stress and the strain, that's the linear relationship or the elastic relationship. And here we have the breaking point, which is sometimes called the ultimate strength. Of the material. Okay, so if I take a pretty fine cross-sectional area, like with this fish line, and if I take a relatively plastic material, like fish line, then with only moderate forces, I'll get pretty big stresses, right? Very small area, so a smallish force will produce a pretty big stress, and so we should be able to see maybe a noticeable amount of strain. So here's a 2 kilo thing, and I don't know, people up close could probably see that went down maybe a centimeter or so. And if I keep adding stuff on, I get more strain, but eventually I'll reach the elastic limit. That's doing good. So these are 2 kilos, so we're at 8 kilos. Pretty big fish. So there we go. Someplace around 9 kilos, or a force that is 9 times G over a very small cross-sectional area, just the cross-sectional area of that wire, that produced a strain that was ultimately the breaking point that we had of that material. Okay, so if we're talking Young's modulus, we're talking about elongation or compression. Tensile forces where we're trying to elongate something with tension, or compression forces where we're trying to push it together. And generally speaking, these things are pretty much the same, whether the stress is compression or whether it's expansion. There'd be breaking points either way. Now, some materials like concrete are very different in stress in tension than they are in compression, right? They can hold a whole lot of weight, but if you try and stretch concrete, it'll fracture. So things aren't necessarily the same in tension and compression. Okay, if we look at this rod just sitting here and we think about any piece of it, what sorts of forces have to be present on it? Well, so if we think about cutting that rod at some particular location, we know the center of mass of this piece of it is someplace out there. So there's a torque that's trying to twist it that way. And that means that there must be some countervailing torque that's occurring at those edges to support it. And there also has to occur a lifting force, kind of like that multiple choice problem, all at that same spot. Right? So there's a torque that's involved in supporting against the torque of gravity, and there's also a vertical force that has to support it against the force of gravity. If we concentrate on this vertical force, and notice that this pretty much has to be the same. I mean, the weight is getting less, I guess, but approximately speaking, it's going to be the same as we go out. So we have a situation where we have something that is being pushed one way in one direction and the other and equally and oppositely in the other direction, as opposed to a compression or an expansion. So this is called a stress, and we have a similar sort of relationship between the deflection that we get and the corresponding force per area. Okay, so very similar sort of relationship, a different modulus, a stress modulus, and what we have, so if I apply forces like this, this thing is going to shift over some distance, let me call it delta x, and it has some length L. So this is going to be the corresponding stress.
What is this one called?
This is the stress. This is the shear. Okay, so shape of solids are going to change according to the stresses that are put on them, whether it's a tangential shear stress or whether it's a compression or an extension stress. And finally, we have kind of a uniform stress where the whole volume of the object is changing. So this is called the bulk modulus. So if we look at the change in volume of the thing, that's going to be related to the corresponding stress, which of course is still the pressure, the force per area. So water, which we think about as being incompressible, isn't perfectly incompressible. If you apply a force to it, if you apply a pressure to it, it will reduce its volume slightly in response to that. And that's equivalent to saying that the bulk modulus for water is huge. And of course, similarly so for other sorts of solids. Okay? So solids respond to stress with strain, and we have these sorts of approximate linear relationships between stress and strain. And typically, if you are constructing something, you don't want to come anywhere close to this ultimate strength where you're going to have breaking. So usually you try and build your buildings which are in the linear region between stress and strain. Okay, so much for solids. About liquids. And typically what applies to liquids also applies to gases, as long as we're not talking about velocities of the gas that are comparable to the speed of sound. So roughly, air, you know, is in fact compressible, but we can ignore its compressibility if the forces are not all that large. So the main game here is again going to be pressure. And if we're thinking about air to start with, right? So if I take this thing and I drop it, it falls. So here's a piece of air. Why doesn't it fall? It has mass. Air has a density, which I hope you remember is mass per volume, which is about 1.3 kilograms per cubic meter. You know, so there's about a kilogram of mass of air there, but it doesn't seem to be falling. So if it's not falling, that means that there must be some force that is holding it up. So if we talk about water as opposed to air, if this is our piece of water, the only reason it's not falling, it certainly has a certain mass, which we could calculate by the area and this height. Right, so area times height in this circumstance would be the volume. The density, usually denoted by the Greek letter rho. If we multiply the density times the volume, we're going to get the mass. So there's a downward force that's equal to mg. So why doesn't it fall? Well, it must be that there's some upward going force that is pushing it up. And that upward going force is the pressure at depth times the area. So since this thing isn't falling, it must be that these things are the same. My P's and rho's look a lot alike. So this is a P. So we have P times the area. Notice that the area cancels out. So we get rho gh has to equal the pressure. Now that isn't quite true because there is pressure on the top too. There's atmospheric pressure that is pushing down. So really it's the difference in pressure that matters, right? This pressure is pushing up, this one's pushing down. So it's the difference in pressure between the top and the bottom that is supporting that piece of water against the force of gravity. Now we can, kind of generalize this. If we call the pressure on top of the fluid P naught, then if we go down some depth H, The pressure here is going to be the pressure at the top plus rho gh. Okay, so this volume has a force that's pushing up on it that is about the mass, which is roughly speaking 1.3 kilograms times g, right? So roughly speaking, there's 10 newtons that's pushing that object up. And the only reason it's not going up is it weighs 10 newtons. But if I take this thing and I fill it with something that weighs less than 10 newtons, then there'll be a net force on it up. So if I take my imaginary cube of air, and instead of filling it with air, I fill it with, say, helium that weighs less, the net pressure force, the pressure is more on the bottom than it is on the top, the net pressure force is exactly what it was before. But this thing weighs less, so there's going to be a net force up on this helium. So we have a name for this net pressure force that is pushing things up. It's called the buoyant force. And in general, it looks to be kind of a hard thing to calculate. That is to say, we have to know what the pressure is on the bottom. We have to know what the pressure is on the top. Conceivably, there could be different pressures on the side, but it's kind of natural that they're going to cancel going left to right. So it looks to be kind of a hard thing to calculate. But we know that the buoyant force has to exactly equal the weight of air that would be in that spot, because the air isn't moving up or down. So the buoyant force has to equal what's called the mass of the fluid that's displaced, right? When I fill this with helium as opposed to air, I'm displacing a lot of air. Times g. So this is an upward force on things. So for a helium balloon, this upward force would be the density of air, which is at sea level about 1.3 kilograms per cubic meter, times the volume of this balloon. And if it's a sphere, the formula for the volume of a sphere is 4/3 pi r cubed times g. And of course, the force of gravity down is going to be the density of the helium times that same volume. And since the density of helium is less than the density of air, we have a net upward force, a net buoyant force on that object. Okay. So let's take a look at some problems. So here we have a rod that is in part made of aluminum and in part made of copper. And it's put under a tension. Tension means that you're trying to elongate it. So that means both ends of this are being pulled with a force that is 5.8 times 10 to the third newtons. And we're supposed to figure out how much elongation we get. Okay. So we've got 1.3 meters of aluminum, and we've got 2.6 meters of copper. Now we can look in the book. There are nice tables of the Young's moduluses of these materials. So on page 283, we see that the Young's modulus for aluminum is about 7 times 10 to the 10th, and the Young's modulus for copper is about 11 times 10 to the 10th. So we are subjecting, pulling on either end, it's not going any place, so there better be an equal and opposite force on it. That is 5.8 times 10 to the third newtons. And if you think about it, that's the same tension all the way through this piece, right? If you look at any piece, it has to be being pulled to the left and the right by that same amount, or else there would be a net force on the left-hand or right-hand piece of the object. So the aluminum is under this tension, the copper is under this tension, there's no difference in the tension anywhere between any piece of this object. Okay, so the starting point, of course, is going to get the stress, and the stress is the force per area. We know what the force is, and the area, we can calculate it because it tells us that the radius is 0.2 centimeters. So cross-sectional area, the area of a circle, is pi r squared. Remember to convert your centimeters into meters. And this is what the stress would be.
And,
oh, thank you. 0.2 centimeters. And we know that we can calculate the strain, which is the change in length over length, by taking that stress and dividing it by the corresponding Young's modulus. So the stretch of any one of these pieces we can get by taking the length and multiplying it by the stress and dividing it by the Young's modulus. Okay, so we need to do that for the aluminum, calculate how much longer it's going to be, do that for the copper, see how much longer it's going to be, and then of course the total stretch of the composite object is going to be the sum of those two pieces. Yes?
So if we have a problem like this and it says the tension is, we know the tension is equal on both sides, it's not like half the tension on each side.
Yeah. So if you think about it, it has to be that way, right? If this thing was being pulled with 6 times 10 to the third newtons that way, and it was only being pulled 3 times 10 to the newtons that way, there'd be a net force on it.
Oh, no, I meant like the tension would just be equal, is the total on each side, right? So like 5.8 on each side, not 2.54 on each side.
Correct. Oh, I see. You're saying when people define tension, are they automatically giving you
both
one
sides.
Force as opposed to both sides added together?
Yeah.
They're always giving you just one side. And that has to be the same any place you cut this piece.
Yeah, then so the outside is the same.
Mm-hmm. So the outside it also has to be the same. And that's kind of the natural thing to do, because typically if you were going to try and measure the tension that's on the system, it's easy to measure this mass. You know, why bother to multiply it by 2 to count the upward force at this upward area? Okay, so at this point it's kind of just plug and chug. So for the aluminum, we have the length of the aluminum, which is 1.3 meters. We've got the stress, and we've got the Young's modulus. Yeah, might as well calculate that stress now, I guess. So we've got the 5.8 times 10 to the third newtons. 5.8. And then we've got the 0.002 that we're supposed to square and multiply by pi and divide all of that, and we get a stress that is 4.62 basically times 10 to the 8th pascals. So for the aluminum, we're going to have that 4.62 divided by the Young's modulus, quite naturally a lot bigger. And exactly the same thing for the copper. It's got an even larger Young's modulus. We can check out our units, right? The Pascals are going to cancel. So the units we're going to have for delta L, or whatever we put in for L. And if we crank away at this, we've got 7 and our exponent 10. We're supposed to divide that by, and then 1.3 times it. And this is 8.6 millimeters, 10 to the minus 3 meters. And this is 10.9 millimeters. So if we add those together, we're going to get something close to 20 millimeters. Okay, so simple sorts of problems with how solids deform given the forces that are on them. So liquids kind of allow for more challenging problems. And here's kind of a tricky one. What we have is this sort of tube that has different areas on either side. And of course, with one liquid here, it's going to go up to exactly the same height on either side. And what we've got in here is mercury, which you know has a density that is way bigger than that of water. So in this class, we're typically going to end up writing densities, for example, the density of water, in terms of kilograms per cubic meter. But it's way more common to see densities in terms of grams per cubic centimeter. So 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter is exactly the same thing as 1 gram per cubic centimeter. And I'm at least much more used to seeing this for for my units of density. So in any case, mercury weighs roughly has a density that's roughly 14 times the density of water. So now we're going to pour water into this side, and quite naturally, because water is less dense than mercury, the mercury isn't going to go up nearly as much as the water. And we're supposed to figure out how high the mercury goes up, given that we've poured 100 grams, which is to say 100 cc's of water on this side. Okay. So the starting point, I think, is to think about the iceberg. May not seem like an obvious starting point, but if we have an object that is floating in a fluid, so I'm going to have a fluid that has some density rho f and an object that has some density rho, I hope you know that in order to float, it has to be that the density of the object is less than the density of the fluid. And as we look at lower and lower density materials, right? So here might be styrofoam with a very low density, it's going to float higher. What's the relationship between what fraction of the material is below the water and the corresponding ratio of densities? And it's going to be easiest to calculate this with nice ice cubes as opposed to icebergs of arbitrary shape. But the result is still the same in terms of volumes. So if we think about the mass of this ice cube, the mass we can calculate by the density of the ice times the area times the height of the cube. So the corresponding weight, the force down on this thing, is going to be mg, just like it usually is. And the only reason this thing isn't falling is because there is a pressure force that is pushing up from the bottom. There's also air pressure on the top. And we know that the result of that is that the buoyant force, the upward force, is equal to the mass of the water that's displaced. It's equal to this. If we fill that with water, it would be in equilibrium, so the buoyant force has to be exactly balancing for that case. So the buoyant force is going to be the density of the fluid times the cross-sectional area times x, how far the object is down. And this iceberg is floating, so the force up has to balance the force down. So if I plug in for the mass, rho ah has to be rho fluid ax. Notice that all these are times g. Notice that g cancels out. Doesn't matter whether we do this experiment on Mars or on Earth. And what we get is the fraction of the iceberg that is below the water, x over h, put the h down, that's equal to the density of the iceberg divided by the density of the fluid. So as long as the density on top is less than the density on the bottom, this relationship, x is going to be less than h. It's actually going to float under those circumstances. Okay. So if we think about this kind of funny tube, so here was the original level, and here's the new level of mercury. And here, better put this thing up higher. Here's this plug of water. The fraction of this water that is below sea level is given by the ratio of the densities. So x over h better be the density of water, which is basically 1, divided by the density of mercury. Okay, so that's a starting point, but it's not the end point. The other thing to recognize is that this water has a volume that has to be equal to this. Right? However much the mercury was pushed down on this side in terms of volume, it has to be pushed up on that side. Believe that? Not so sure. So let's make sure we get our variables right. This x, that's the distance that the bottom of the water is from the current level of the mercury. And what we've just said is that if we look at the original level of the mercury, the water has pushed the mercury down here, and it has to go up by that amount there. So if we call the cross-sectional areas of these pipes A1 and A2, and I'm going to call this H2 bottom, I'm going to call this H1 top, then this volume, which is this area times this amount that the mercury has grown up, that's what we want to calculate. That has to be the same thing as this area times this distance. Okay. So this is the thing we want to calculate in the end, so we want to isolate that a little bit. So H, the amount that the mercury went up, has to be this ratio of areas times H to B. Okay, so lots of tricky parts to this problem. If you think about it, that distance is the same as this distance. So this total distance x, we can think about as being made up out of this distance here, h2b, plus this distance here, which is h1t. And we have a formula for this. It's actually the other way around would be helpful. So h2b is going to be h1a, the ratio of the areas times h1t. It's a blue problem. So finally, if we cancel out this thing, if we factor out this thing that we want to calculate, we've got the ratio of the areas plus 1 times h1t. Okay, so we're finally there. So we have that the fraction that's below water depends on the ratio of the densities. So x by itself is going to be h, the ratio of the densities. And we've seen here that x can be related to the height that mercury goes up, which is what we want to calculate. So our final equation, bring this to the other side of the equation. H1t is equal to the total depth of the water, this ratio of areas times the ratios of the densities of water to mercury. Okay, so what we're told is that this side here, A2, has five cross-sectional area of 5 centimeters squared, and we put in 100 grams of water. So the density of water is 1, so 100 grams of water, same thing as 100 cubic centimeters, which is the same thing as 100 cubic milliliters. So what we know is that that height times that area has to be 100 cubic centimeters. So the total height has to be the 100 cubic centimeters divided by the A2 of just 5 centimeters squared. So cubic centimeters over squared centimeters are going to give us centimeters. So the total height of water is 20 centimeters. And finally, we're all set to plug into this. Right, so we've got the 20 centimeters divided by the ratio of the areas, which is 2:1. And then we've got the ratio of the density of water to the density of mercury. And notice that a lot of our units solve themselves, right? Whether these things were in kilograms per cubic meter didn't matter because the units are going to cancel out. These things were in centimeters as opposed to square meters, but it didn't matter because the units canceled out. So the final units we're going to get for this height that it went up are going to be in centimeters. And so it's going to go up about 0.5 centimeter. Okay, that's a blue problem. So here we have a container that is a mixture of water and oil. So we've got 20 centimeters of water on the bottom, and we've got 30 centimeters of oil on top. I know the oil's on top because it has a lower density. It's got a density that's only 0.7. Technically speaking, specific gravity is the ratio of the material to that of water, but water has, in terms of these problems, a density of 1. So the density of this oil is 0.7 grams per milliliter, or grams per cubic centimeter. Now here's a term we haven't run into before, absolute pressure. Everything we've been talking about so far has been an absolute pressure. And we want to contrast that with what's called gauge pressure. So, roughly speaking, atmospheric pressure, I've said, is about 100,000 pascals, and that's roughly speaking about 15 pounds per square inch. So what's kind of a typical pressure in your tires? Depends whether you ride a bike or a car. So for a car, roughly 30 pounds per square inch is kind of a typical pressure. For a bike, something like 100 pounds per square inch. These numbers are all in what's called gauge pressure. And what gauge pressure means has to do with how your measuring instrument works. So when you measure the pressure of the tires in your car, you're typically measuring the pressure difference between atmospheric pressure and what's inside the tires. So gauge pressure is equal to the actual pressure minus atmospheric pressure. And since atmospheric pressure is so relatively big, typically if you see anything that's measuring pressure, it's probably measuring gauge pressure, the pressure above or below atmospheric pressure. Okay, so they want absolute pressure, so they want us to include the pressure of the weight of the air that is above all of that water. So we're thinking about our setup. So here we have our 30 centimeters of oil. And here we have our 20 centimeters of water. And sitting on top, we've got 10 kilometers of air that has a corresponding pressure that is 1.013 times 10 to the fifth pascals. Incidentally, we're not at sea level, so the pressure would be noticeably less in this room. Okay. So we know that the change in pressure for some layer is the density of the fluid, the acceleration of gravity, and the depth of the fluid. So the change in pressure that we get from going from the top to the bottom of this oil, we can calculate by taking the density, 0.7 grams per cubic centimeter, times g, 9.8 meters per second squared, times that depth, 0.3 meters. And you can see we've got a tremendous unit mismatch. And we're going to want to convert this grams per cubic centimeter into kilograms per cubic meter. Right? Then we can have nice cancellations. So I hope you already know what the answer is going to be, but we might as well do this once. Right? The answer is going to be a factor of 1,000 more, so it's going to be 700 kilograms per cubic meter. Let's do it in pieces. So in 1 kilogram, there are 1,000 grams. So the grams can go away. And in 100 centimeters is equal to 1 meter. But I have to do that 3 times to get rid of centimeters cubed. So what I've got is 0.7. The centimeters cubed cancel, the grams cancel, so I'm going to end up with kilograms per cubic meter as desired. I'm going to have 1,000 in the denominator. I'm going to have 100 cubed in the numerator, which is 1,000,000. So we have 0.7 times 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter, or what I promised you at the start, 700 kilograms per cubic meter. So this pressure difference going through that oil ...700 kilograms per cubic meter times 9.8 meters per second squared times 0.3 meters. So let's check our units. Pressure has the units of newtons per meter squared. So I'm only going to cancel out one of the meters from this meter squared. So say I get rid of one of those. And what I have left then are kilogram meters per second squared, which I hope you recognize as a newton. So I get newtons per meter squared, which is a pascal. So in terms of numbers, I've got 700, 9.8 times it, 0.3 times that. So I get 2.06 times 10 to the third pascals. It may look like a lot, but it's only this digit, right? Because this is 10 to the third, 10 to the fifth. Same thing goes for the water. The pressure difference between the top and the bottom of the water is going to be the density of water, which is 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter, 9.8 meters per second times 0.2 meters. Oops. Okay. Start again. Okay, 1,000, 9.8, 0.2, and that's 1.96 times 10 to the third pascals. So the total pressure difference from top to bottom, just have to add those two changes, and it's going to be 4.02 times 10 to the third pascals. That I need to add to this number here, which is what atmospheric pressure was. So I have 0.040 times 10 to the fifth pascals to add to that. So I'm going to get 1.053 times 10 to the fifth pascals. Okay. So atmospheric pressure is the weight of 10 kilometers worth of air, so it's pretty big. Air has a density that's roughly 1,000 times smaller than the density of water. So in order to have a pressure change that's comparable to the mass of all of that air, we need to go down about 1/1000th of 10 kilometers, or about 10 meters, right? So to increase, to double pressure, to double the absolute pressure, we need to go down 10 meters of water. So 20 centimeters of water doesn't do much for changing the pressure. Okay, so for fun, you can fill up 600 balloons, and they call these toy balloons, but they're really weather balloons. They're really pretty big balloons with a diameter of about a meter. And the claim was that a record altitude of basically 2 miles was reached by this guy by filling all 600 of these balloons with helium. And we're supposed to figure out basically how much these balloons could in fact lift. So remember that the buoyant force is the weight of the displaced fluid. So in this case, the displaced fluid is air, right? And roughly speaking, air has a density of about 1.3 kilograms per cubic meter, less on top of Mount Everest. And we're told that the radius of the sphere is 0.5 meters. So the buoyant force is going to be the mass of the air, which is the density of that fluid times the volume of a sphere, which is 4/3 pi times the radius cubed. So all of this is the mass of the air that's displaced times g. And we got 600 of these balloons. And they're going to produce, you know, all of them together, some big force up. The balloons do weigh something, and they tell us that when filled, they weigh 0.3 kilograms. So that's going to be a force down. Hopefully the force up is going to be bigger than the force down. So let's calculate the net buoyant force. We've got our density of 1.3. We've got our radius that is 0.5, g is 9.8, and we got 600 of these balloons. So I'll start with the 4/3 pi. That radius cubed. And then I've got the density, 1.3. I've got g, which is 9.8. And I've got 600 of those balloons. And that basically gives me 4,000 newtons. So this mass, incidentally, is about 408 kilograms. So in contrast, the weight of these balloons, 0.3 kilograms each times 600 of them. That would be the mass. We multiply by g to get the weight. So this is 1.76 thousand newtons. So we've got 2.2 thousand newtons or so of net force up that we can use to lift the person. Kind of for comparison, that 0.3 times 600 is about 180 kilograms. So the person could weigh up to 228 kilograms, which is a pretty heavy person. And still be lifted, at least initially, by these balloons.
What did we calculate right there? 0.3 times 600.
So that's the weight of the balloons. It says that each balloon weighs 0.3 kilograms, and there are 600 of them. Now, presumably, the weight of this guy should also be figured in to see how what's going to happen, but they don't give us his weight. These balloons could lift, basically, 228 kilograms of stuff.
Could you show again how you got the 228, how they,
Ah, so what I... So everything is ending up multiplied by g, right? So I have the buoyant force is the mass of air times g. And here I have the weight of the balloons, which is 180 times g. So I just subtracted those to get the 208. And if I want that in terms of a force, I would need to multiply it by g. So if you go down in the ocean, obviously the pressure gets more and more and more because of rho gh. And obviously the reverse is if you go up in the Earth's atmosphere, right? The air weighs something. So as you go up, the pressure gets less and less and less. And if there's less pressure compressing this balloon, if you go up higher, that balloon is going to expand accordingly. And also the density of the air is going to be less. So all of these things lead to a potential danger, right? The balloon's bursting and getting less buoyant force simply because the fluid weighs less. The fluid is less dense up high. So typically when they make high altitude balloons, they make them with lots of free space, right? So if you ever see a picture of a balloon that is starting to go up, it's very much elongated. And when it reaches altitude, of course, it'll be a nice big sphere. The reduced pressure at altitude allowing the gas to expand. Okay, so here we have a typical spring scale, and we're weighing this object, and we get 5 newtons, and we put it in this fluid, and we get 3.5 newtons. It's sinking. You can see that it's sinking. We're supposed to find the density of the object. Okay, so... Just under normal circumstances, we know that the weight of this object, mg, is the 5 newtons. And of course, it's being supported by this spring. If we put this thing in water, there is an additional buoyant force in addition to the spring force. And of course, it still weighs exactly what it did before, 5 newtons. So the buoyant force, well, we can write this way. The spring force plus the buoyant force still has to equal the 5 newtons. And we know that the spring force is 3.5 newtons. So the buoyant force is the 5 newtons minus the 3.5 newtons, or 1.5 newtons. And we have a formula for the buoyant force, right? The formula for the buoyant force is the density of the fluid, which is water, times the volume displaced, which is the volume of the object, times g. So we can figure out what the volume of the object is by taking this buoyant force and dividing it by the density of water, which is 1,000, and g. This will, of course, give us the very tiny volume in cubic meters. So we get a volume that is just about 1.53 times 10 to the minus 4th cubic meters. The mass of the object we can get from its original weight. So the mass of the object has to be the 5 newtons divided by 9.8. So it weighs about half a kilogram. And of course, the density is that mass, 0.51 kilograms, divided by this volume, 1.53 times 10 to the minus 4th cubic meters. And we're expecting to get something that is thousands of kilograms per cubic meters, right, given the kind of funny units we're using. And we get, in fact, 3,333 kilograms per cubic meter, or in normal units, 3.33 grams per cubic centimeter, grams per milliliter.
On the top equation, what did you start with as like a base equation?
So the definition of density. The definition of density is mass per volume. Okay. So in terms of kind of a large number, more than the usual number of equations we've talked about today, we've got the relationships between stress. Remember, this is measured in the units of force per area, and strain. We've got different bulk moduluses. We've got Young's modulus, we've got Shear's modulus, we've got bulk modulus for different sorts of situations. Young's modulus for when we're compressing or expanding, strain for when we're pushing it tangentially, and bulk when we're dealing with change in volumes as opposed to changes in linear dimensions. And then for fluids, we've got the change in the pressure is rho gh. And Archimedes' formula for the buoyant force, namely the buoyant force is the mass of the fluid that's displaced times g. So that's going to be the density of the fluid, the volume that's displaced times g. Okie doke.